Today is the 7th of July 2009. I'm with Hadi Susastro at the CSIS offices at the Jakarta Post Building in Jakarta. And before we start the interview, can I ask that you've given your consent for this interview?
Yes, certainly.
All right, thank you very much. So I'd like to start this interview just talking about and asking you questions about what you've done in the past and what's led you up to your current position, and then what you're currently involved in and what your current responsibilities are.
I have been with CSIS now for 38 years, and I've always been with this institution, doing different things over the years. But of the 38 years that I have been here, I have in total been the executive director for about 20 years until January this year. So I'm now a senior fellow, basically doing just research, which I wanted to do. And my main field of research is in the area of international trade, a little bit of international finance, but also regional economic cooperation, and some aspects of the domestic economy, which includes also decentralization.
Okay. And what does CSIS do?
Oh, basically, it's a non-profit, a research institution doing policy analysis of both domestic and international regional issues. And the purpose is to provide some input and also encourage debate in the country in order to improve public policy making.
And does it have any particular focuses in terms of its area?
No, it has a very, very broad research agenda. We are organized in two different research departments now, initially three, economics department and then political and international relations. It used to be economics, political and social change, and international relations. So the two departments are now merged into one.
Okay. And have you had any involvement in with the government in any of the reforms that have taken place in Indonesia?
Well, in fact, through CSIS, during the height of the reforms in the latter half of the 1980s, we had a lot of sort of interactions with the government. And in fact, what we did mostly is to provide information to the public at large as to why it was important to undertake the various reforms. At that time, the word used was deregulation. In effect, it was aimed at liberalizing the economy, but we didn't use the word liberalization. It was still, even in the late 1980s, considered to be a dirty word in Indonesia. So it was deregulation, basically. So that's how we began. At the time of the reforms, since 1998, we continued to be very active in terms of, reforming the economy. And I happened to be a member of the National Economic Council under President Abdurrahman Wahid.
And that was in the late 90s. That was what
Yes, until 2001. 2001 to 2002, sorry. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And could you briefly describe the reforms that made up the deregulation? What sort of reforms were these?
The reforms. Well, maybe a little bit of background. The Indonesian economy over the years then had become too dependent on revenues from one major source, namely oil and gas. I can't give you the exact figures anymore, but it used to be that about 40% of total exports came from oil. And 60% of total government revenues came from oil. So during the oil boom years, you know, we were very happy, but then forgot that in fact there is a serious implications for the economy of this sudden, you know, increase in revenues from natural resources, which is known as the Dutch disease, causing, you know, your exchange rate to appreciate and all that. But basically, you know, everybody became too complacent that, you know, we had all these resources. And so with interest, with exchange rates appreciating, the economy became less and less internationally competitive. And so, you know, in the late 1970s, we found out when all of a sudden the price of oil, you know, 78 to 81, the price of oil declined, that, you know, our revenues shrank, you know, and it became very serious, including the balance of payments was severely affected. That led the government and the economic managers of the country to, in fact, institute the reforms, the deregulation, to make the economy more competitive, because, you know, there were a lot, you know, the external sector was very protected, you know, many things like import licensing and so on. You know, they were dismantled gradually, beginning in 1986 with the first deregulation package in October of that year, and then followed, you know, every few months with additional, you know, what we call packages of reforms or deregulation packages, you know, removing one by one the different constraints and barriers to the economy. It didn't follow a particular sequencing. You know, we know that in the literature there is this sequencing, you know, what is it that you need to do first, but in fact it was done purely pragmatically. Whichever, you know, whatever opportunity there was, it was being tackled. And you have to understand that the deregulation was possible because the economic management of this country at that time was still very much left to a group of economic technocrats. There was rather insulated from the political processes. And so they could, in fact, introduce and institute these reforms, of course, in the end, with the blessing of the president, with the agreement of the president. And this was possible because of a situation of crisis, and not because of ideological reasons. It was purely pragmatic. Yeah, that so, we needed to do that.
So why 1986? What was the crisis that prompted these reforms?
Oh, 86.
Why
the
that
drop
year?
In oil prices, okay, from about $30 per barrel to $9 per barrel. There was a major impact on the economy. Mm. Yeah.
And the main drivers of reform were the
economic technocrats. Yes.
Okay.
And what they had to face then was the very entrenched interest groups, okay, in industry, in trade, you know, in various areas.
So what sort of interest groups were those?
Oh, industry groups,
yeah.
Yes. Industry groups who wanted to maintain high tariff protections, okay, but also traders who wanted to keep their import licensing, a very elaborate import licensing system. Basically, those are all monopolists.
All right.
Yeah. So the government began to open up in those sectors.
So what was included in that first round of reforms in October of 1986?
Of course, the one was tackled first was the export sector, how to make them competitive. The reason why, you know, they have become less competitive are not only the the interest rate, the exchange rate, but also because they had been forced to use local inputs, even though, you know, it's much costly, much more, you know, costly, like plastics, iron and steel. They had to use the ones produced locally, even though the cost is so much higher.
And that was by legislation or by policy?
By policy. Okay. By policy. And in fact, the policy was instituted to protect the local industries from it. So that was dismantled, and saying that if your product are going were going to be exported, you have the choice now to purchase your inputs from abroad.
And presumably those companies or those and those industries that were providing those local inputs that were required resisted this change. What did they do to resist this, and how did the government get around that sort of resistance?
Oh, they tried all, you know, through all kinds of means. Iron and steel were, in fact, state-owned enterprises. So, you know, they had to follow. Although they tried, they used a lot of lobbying power and so on. But in the end, they had to accept. The private sector ones, there was a little bit more tricky, because by then there was this growing cronyism in the country, you know, that these big industries were all, you know, related to or owned by those close to the president. And so, you know, it was a big struggle between the technocrats and this. So it's an ongoing struggle.
So why do you think the technocrats were successful in the late 80s?
Because I believe the public supported the deregulation pressures. You know, and I don't want to, in fact, boast, but in fact, you know, the academics, you know, including, you know, us in this institution, as well as the Faculty of Economics, the University of Indonesia, and so on, try to explain to the public, you know, why we had to do this. Because it is against the grain of thinking in this country, you know. We have a constitution, a constitution which we regarded as sacred, cannot change, and in that constitution, you know, in fact, the management of the economy was based on, you know, a paradigm which was there from the 40s, 1940s, very much influenced by thinking in Europe at that time, you know, socialist, democratic, socialist ideas, which became our constitution, and we haven't changed it.
Okay. And the president obviously had different people wanting different things from him. So, how was he persuaded to go along with the technocrats
because of the crisis? Because of the crisis, and you know, by then he was already in power for about 20 years, and he knew that in the previous 20 years there were many crises, you know, several times, and each time we were able to overcome this because the team that was still there, it's the same economic team, basically, you know, had been able to maintain macroeconomic stability. And so they used the same formula, saying that, you know, we have to do this because, you know, once we let this go, it will be very difficult to do it. So he supported this. And in fact, the president in the end agreed to postponed big projects, you know, and so on. And in fact, also, to some extent, you know, allowed some of the companies that were owned by people close to him, to change, they have to change also. Yeah.
Was there any international pressure?
Not at that time. You know, the story was repeated later on 97, 98, yeah, during the crisis, with totally different results.
Okay, well, I'd like to talk to you about that. Later. We'll get to that a little bit later. So what was the subsequent sequence then after 1986, once the export sector was
yes,
deregulated?
Yes, and then it became trade first, and then investment and industrial reform. Because the industrial sector, you know, related to foreign investment and all, were very much regulated, in that each year the government would produce what they called a negative investment list. You know, at the end of each year, the government will then decide which industrial manufacturing sectors can be opened up and by how much. You know, this is, and the argument was that we have to protect the existing industries from the entrance of new ones, and they can only do so if the demand for the respective product is known to have increased, you know, significantly, and the existing industries cannot meet the demand. That's the only reason for opening up. You know, you are an existing investor, you want to increase your line of, you know, in the same line of product, but increase your output, you also had to then ask for permission. You know, that's how regulated the economy was. It was also dismantled, you know, in the course of several years, from 86 all the way to 91, 92.
And why was it spread out over 6 or 7 years?
Oh, that's, you know, that's the political economy. Yeah, yeah, you know. So each time there is an opportunity, then they tackle one thing and so on. And the financial, the deregulation of the financial sector came only in the late 1980s, 88, 89, you know, because, and in fact, it moved very fast, because that is the sector where the technocrats had full control of it.
Okay.
Yeah, because the central bank, the Ministry of Finance, are all people from that same economic group.
Okay. Yeah. You said that there wasn't, you didn't follow a particular sequence, and instead it was a pragmatic approach to try and to take advantage of opportunities. What sort of opportunities are the?
Yeah,
you know,
one example
about?
Is, you know, usually the financial sector reform would come at the very end, you know, and the argument is that once you complete your real sector reforms, only then should you go into this, because otherwise, you know, you already deregulate the financial sectors, but if the real sector continues to be regulated, then you create a lot of distortions in resource allocation. Eh? So you have to, but we could not afford to do so. So as soon as in 1988, 2 years after we began with the reforms, there was the opportunity to move into, you know, financial sector reform swiftly. The government did that, or the technocrats did that, at the risk of, you know.
So what was that opportunity? Why did they feel they could do it in 1988?
Oh, well, what they did was, you know, initially, state-owned enterprises were forced to, you know, use only state banks, state-owned banks. And I think that was the first thing that was tackled, saying that no, now they can also go into use private sector banks. Now that you asked me about it, I have never, in fact, looked into this more closely. But I think because one of the larger, by then, the larger private sector bank, yeah, is owned by somebody who has very close relations to the president. Not so that I think of it. Yeah.
So at some points, it's the cronyism slows down reform in other, at other times.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I can give you other examples of that, namely the building of toll roads, you know, some of the main toll roads that we have now, all originated during that period, you know, and otherwise we wouldn't be able to do that. The other one is the opening up of the information sector. With, you know, we have so many private TV channels now, was also because of cronyism. Then,
okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something that was totally closed before. It's only the state-owned television, TVRI, that was there before. And so, you know, that changed during the time because Suharto's children want to go in there.
Yeah. Okay. So, what difference did the political setup make to the reform attempts in the late 80s and early 90s? The fact that Suharto had a lot of control over the country. How did that affect the way reform happened, as opposed to a more democratic country doing similar reforms?
Oh, yeah, well, it depends very much on his mood also, yeah. You know, by the sort of 92, 93, 94, you know, because you have already deregulated many of the sectors that was possible, you know, there were a few remaining sectors. It's the tough ones. And those are the ones that very closely related to him.
And so which areas were those?
In his children, iron and steel still.
Okay.
A few plastic chemicals, yeah. Uh-huh.
So he kept those areas.
And then also, you know, the big strategic industry like the aircraft industry and so on. That, you know, he protected.
Okay, so he kept the industries which he was involved in regulated.
Yes, that's right. And so we began to see a slowing down of the deregulation process. Around 93, 94, people were talking about the deregulation fatigue in the country, and then the crisis happened in 97. And if we can jump to that
certainly
part, you know, the 97 crisis came. Initially, we thought we're going to be saved from it because the macroeconomic situation of Indonesia was, you know, so much better than our neighbors. Malaysia and Thailand experienced a balance of a current account deficit of about 6 to 8% already then. We didn't. You know, I think it below 2% only. Our budget was in surplus and so on. Yeah? But then we never knew about what was later on called contagion, the contagion effect, which was something that hit Indonesia hard. But once we felt the impact of this crisis, you know, the technocrats thought, well, you know, there is a crisis coming up. We will have to use the same argument as before, you know, to reopen the whole reform process in 1997-98, not knowing that by then it was already a different Suharto from the one before, you know. This time, the Suharto was very combative, because he really wanted to save the industries and the business activities of his cronies, his children, and also the strategic industries. Mm-hmm. And initially, we invited the IMF to come only to provide us with advice, because we did all the things that needed to be done. As soon as we felt the crisis, we floated the exchange rate, not knowing that people reacted, overreacted to it, and then the budget was cut, and so on. Yeah? And yet it didn't help because of the contagious effect. You know, each time when Mahathir Mohamad in Malaysia opened his mouth, the stock market there fell it affected our stock market and so on, you know. So that happened. So we brought in the IMF. And during the time of, you know, this process of consultation, it was felt that perhaps we do need to negotiate a package with the IMF. Once this was negotiated, the structural reform programs that, you know, got stuck were included in the package. You know, often from the outside, it was seen as the mistake of the fund. In fact, you know, I knew the process. They were very reluctant at the beginning to do so. The fund, the International Monetary Fund, saying that this is not the area of our competence. We know nothing about structural reforms, you know, reform of the manufacturing sector, trade, and so on. It's only the financial sector that we wanted to you know, include in the package, you know, including fiscal and so on, but not structural policies. It was the World Bank that said, have to. The Indonesian ministers also said, we have to put it in. And in fact, even outsiders like us, you know, at that time said, it is important. Because the package has to be credible, that we are going to change. You know, it's only a credible package that will help us. So you have to include that. And we misjudged the whole thing, because once we included the structural reform programs in the big IMF package, you know, it became the source of the big mistakes for two reasons. One is that we could not fulfill what we pledged to do, because domestically there was limited support for it. Especially the president was very combative, so he did not agree to it.
Yeah. And that was because he was trying to maintain control over yes. industries controlled by friends.
Yeah. And also, family. You know, his favorite minister, Minister Habibi, of, you know, the science and technology minister, who is in charge of all the strategic industries, who later became his vice president and then president. So that he wanted to save also. But they were brought into the package. And then later on in January, when they reissued the package, it was made very explicit.
What year?
98. January, yeah. 98. You know, the first package was October 97, and then January 98, they were renegotiated, and Suharto himself was the one that negotiated with the managing director of the IMF. Now, the problem why it became not credible was that after they signed this document, each one went to a different room to give a press interview. And it was in that press interview that people immediately observed that they have a totally different understanding of what they have, you know, signed. That essentially Suharto did not agree to what the IMF thought the agreement was. And so, you know, market confidence was lost.
Okay, so Suharto didn't last, much longer after that.
Yes,
right.
Yeah, yeah. And just a few months more.
And there've been a number of reforms attempted since that, so across the sector, across the country, and particularly in the Ministry of Finance. Could you tell me a little bit about those reforms?
Oh, the reforms in the Ministry of Finance came much later, though, in 2004. Yes, from 2004 on. So from 98 to 2004, we still, let me back off a little bit. We had these reform packages under the IMF.
Yeah.
You know, continuously. And I don't have the numbers now, but, you know, we renegotiated a new package every time we changed governments, because we had three or four presidents within a short period of time. Some of the reforms, in fact, were undertaken. Certainly in the financial sector, there was a lot happening. Yeah.
Why were those undertaken but others weren't?
Oh, because in the financial sector again, you know, once the government agrees to do it, they can. You know, okay. The financial sector was very much an area which is under the full control of the state-owned banks, and even the big banks were all in trouble already, taken over by the government, you know, okay. And so on. It was easier to do it. It was in the manufacturing sector that things were very difficult to continue, but also the other reforms. You know, the more important reforms instituted under the IMF packages were institutional reforms, governance basically, good governance, you know, so the introduction of independent institutions, including an independent central bank, you know, from what you used to be seen as being the cashier for the government, you know, changed into an independent institution with a clear mission and task to do and so on. So those were rather more successful. The introduction of the competition commission and a competition law, you know, a bankruptcy, procedure, including bankruptcy court, and so on. They were all introduced within the period from 1999 or 2000 to about 2003, yes. And then in 2004, I think, we decided to end the program with the IMF. We paid all the debt we have to the IMF. And it was then that a new reform package was introduced, which was 100% indigenous. You know, so it was crafted by the government to replace the IMF package.
So just before we go on to that, can I ask you about the reforms from 1998 until 2004?
Yes.
Why do you think they were successful?
You know, my interpretation was because there was the IMF.
Okay, so there was a lot of international pressure?
Oh, yeah. Basically, the IMF. You know, we had these changes in government. And without the IMF, there was no way that you can institute this because the nature of the political changes was the rise of the re-emergence of political parties in this country and the assertiveness of the parliament who wanted to be more populist, you know, and all these things. There was no way they could institute those reforms because it was all against the ideas that political parties had. So it was only because the IMF was there.
Right. And was there any problem trying to continue the reforms over political change?
Yes.
And how were those problems overcome? And what sort of things did those problems bring up?
it varies from time to time under different precedents and so on. I give you just one example. Because I sat in the National Economic Council under President Wahid.
How long was Wahid president for?
Oh, it was less than 2 years.
Okay.
Only, less than 2 years. But it was in his first year that he you know, he set up this National Economic Council, and you know, his argument was that I needed a second opinion because he had his own economic team, but he didn't know the people. For some reason, I don't know why, but you know, I have to do some more research again on this. He instituted this National Economic Council, and we thought our task was to educate him on economic matters. He had no idea, you know, about economics. So we tried to educate him. We were not successful, but what we were successful, I think, in doing was to save the reform programs because Abdurrahman Wahid's ministers were all against them. The coordinating minister for the economy, you know, in fact, sabotaged.
So why did he do that?
because he came from a political party, PTIP, that is totally against the involvement of the IMF.
Okay. So the involvement of the IMF was the main concern, not necessarily the content of the reforms?
Oh yeah. Yes. For some groups, you know, that was the main argument.
It didn't matter what the reforms were if the IMF was involved.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They were bad.
Yeah.
And so why did Wahid choose this minister if he knew that he was going to...
Oh, he didn't know. I thought he should know, okay, because we know this person, we know it, the background, we know the political party. But for some reason, you know, initially, it was not an important thing for Wahid, the economy. Okay. He didn't pay much attention to the economy. Yeah.
Hmm. And so, what was his focus on?
Oh, domestic political issues, yeah. Trying to go through the reform, political reforms, that was his main. And of course, his strength was maintaining pluralism and so on. You know, so
he was from a religious party.
Oh, yeah. But of course, while he is a Muslim leader, he was the one that fought against Muslim fanaticism. Okay. You know, he was very strong. And in fact, that's where he was a great man. But nothing else. All very disastrous. The way he managed the country was very disastrous.
And was that also the time during which the decentralization program was started?
No, earlier. Okay. Well, the decentralization law was introduced in 1999 under Habibie. But it was only implemented in 2001 under him.
Under him, okay.
Yes.
And what was the reason for that delay?
Oh, you know, it takes time. You know, once you pass the law, you have to have implementing regulations and all that for things to begin to move. But, you know, in fact, I think the law was passed like in May or June 1999, but January 1st, 2001, it was already implemented. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So it was less than 2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah? And it was, in fact, in a hurry. And therefore, of the problems.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about that. But before we go on to the decentralization program, I wanted to ask, in which way did the Minister for Economic Coordination sabotage the reforms? What were some of the things that he did or that other people did to try and stall the reforms?
Well, I have to tell you a lot of confidential stories here. But basically, it's this. You know, he is the coordinating minister who is in charge of this. You know, when they negotiate a package with the IMF, you know, in fact, he didn't want to participate in it and said, it's totally yours. So the IMF was very frustrated. And they came to see members of the National Economic Council and said, we can't work like this, you know, because it has to be your package, not ours. So, you know, we had a discussion with Stanley Fisher all the time from the IMF. And in fact, the members of the National Economic Council, which was chaired by Professor Emil Salim, and Sri Mulyani, who is now was the secretary to it.
Is now the finance minister.
Yeah. She was the secretary to it. We were all trying to save the program and make it an Indonesian program by agreeing with Stanley Fisher, we are going to draft the program. The next program we are going to draft. So in that meeting, we called the coordinating minister and said, we have had a discussion with the IMF. The IMF agrees that this time the package should be written by us. You know? We should. So, and we make ourselves available to help you do it. What he said is, no, thank you. Let them do it themselves, you know, so that we can blame all the mistakes to them. Yeah? Okay. It's one example.
Yeah. And who was ultimately responsible for most of the reforms? Was it the president? Were there cabinet ministers? Was there a separate
commission? Oh, yeah, commission? Of course. You know, you know the structure of the reforms. The reforms will always identify, you know, this task has to be done by whom, who is responsible, and then, you know, what they should deliver. You know, it's all made clear. Huh? Yeah. But the problem was that the coordinating minister was not coordinating this, so there was no sense of ownership on the part of the different ministries. The package was signed by him also, but nobody felt like, you know, they're committed to doing it. So there was the big problem with the reforms then.
Okay.
So only those that are immediately managed by the, you know, members of the group who really wanted to do the reform made use of it, you know, made use of the packets to get the reform done.
And
like, with some successes.
Yeah. Which group? What group was this?
Oh, it was also the technocrats.
Okay.
Yeah, still the technocrats that did that.
Working within various ministries.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. But, you know, those that did not want to, you know, bother about it will do nothing. Yeah.
And the high-level political support was elsewhere. And how much political pressure was there on these people to get reforms done?
Oh, not much. Okay. Not much. You know, not much. It's all not from the inside, too. It's all from external. Okay. In fact, it's the IMF. Who became very unpopular because of this. Nobody in the country, except for, you know, the few academics and so on, but we don't count. You know, political parties are not interested, you know, because it's an IMF program, why should we do it? So it depends on the individual ministers. And so one of, I think the credit has to be given to Budiono, you know, for getting the reform through during the period of 2002 to 2004 when he was finance minister under Megawati.
Okay.
That's where he did a lot. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And Megawati didn't understand a thing, but she gave full, what is it, carte blanche, a blank check to Budiono to do it, and in fact supported him 100%.
Okay,
you know?
So they after 2002, between 2002 and 2004, they did develop some political political support.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's from the inside.
Yeah.
Not from the outside. It was only because Megawati supported
Budiono.
Provided full support to Budiono. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And what had happened to the people who had large commercial and industrial interests in the country? So the people who had been Suharto's cronies, what was their involvement during the early 2000s?
Early 2000. Well, they all tried to make deals, of course. It began already with Habibi. The big deals of, you know, this, what do you call it? But it was also under the IMF program, you know, because the IMF program said you have to make an end to this, you know. So you have to settle. Have you studied the history of these things? You know, there was this and mutual settlement agreement, something like that, between the government and the big conglomerates, you know, that they had to surrender, you know, some of their assets to the government in exchange for their debt to the government that they received during these emergency funds to the big banks, you know, that experienced this bank runs, the BLBI case, you know, which is until now not settled, But there was the attempt to settle it then. It was an emergency. They were given the funding from the central bank, and, you know, to just settle it, whoever had assets, you know, they were valued at the time, and then they had to surrender to the government, and then, you know, it was supposed to be settled. But then, you know, each time there was a new government, they reopened the case.
Yeah. So what reform do you think was, at the time, what reform did you think was least likely to happen that was eventually implemented? Were there any particularly difficult reforms that eventually managed to get through?
Oh, it was the political reforms. Well, in fact, I'm not sure that it would not have happened, because it was a reaction to what people thought were the abuses of the previous government.
The Suharto government?
The Suharto government, like staying in power for too long and so on, you know, became the basis for amending the constitution. Yeah? Although it became very difficult, in the process, because you have groups in the society that didn't want to amend the constitution, saying that, you know, as I said, it was something sacred, it was given, it was created at the time of our independence, we should stick to it. But our constitution gave too much power to the presidency, so we had to change it, and it did happen. The decentralization would not have happened did we not have this crisis, and because of the weakening of the central government, you know, there was the only way we were able to maintain the unity of the country, by devolving power. Otherwise, you know, certain provinces were going to just separate from the country if you continue with, you know, the governance structure.
So it was separatist threats that was the driving force behind decentralization?
Yes. But it went a little bit too far, and, you know, one of the impact of the problem that we're facing now is that the power was devolved to the second level of government rather than to the provinces. It went, you know, one level down. The argument that Habibie had then is that if you give it to the provinces, they will have sufficient critical mass to separate. But if you give down to the district level, you know, they won't have the power.
So districts are too small to separate, whereas the provinces would have been large enough.
That's right. So that was the reason why we went all the way down to the second level and created 500 kingdoms in the country.
Okay.
As a result.
All right. And who was mainly involved in designing the decentralization process?
A group of young people. What is his name? Who then became the minister for a while. His name slipped. Bambang, orang Sumatera yang dulu pernah jadi menteri yang urusan desentralisasi, namanya pakai R. Orang Makassar, siapa namanya yang muda itu menteri?
Yang mana ya, Pak?
Menteri yang muda pakai R. Bukan dalam negeri, tapi pokoknya Rias Rashid. Rias Rashid was the architect of the decentralization. Rias Rashid. In fact, he was supported by people like Andi Malarangeng and so on. These very young people. Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. And so after Suharto stepped down or was pushed out, what happened to his political allies in the political system that replaced him, and how did that affect the political reform that took place afterwards?
Well, compared to some other countries, like in particular Korea, and maybe to some extent Thailand, where there was a total change in the political setup, it was not the case of Indonesia. So Suharto's allies continued to be there, even under Habibie. You know, so the change was very gradual.
All right.
The change was very, the political change was very gradual, not abrupt, you know.
And what effect did that have on the governance and the changes and the economic changes?
It was very slow because of that, okay. You know. Yeah. It was very slow.
So they provided resistance. What sort of positions did they stay in?
Oh, ministers? some still ministers. Okay. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The real change, I think, only happened when Megawati became president.
In 2004.
She totally changed the people there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So to go back to the decentralization, you said that it happened very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I understand that they moved 2.5 million staff members in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
Why did it happen so quickly? I understand that the Act says that there should have been analysis done and planning, and that much of this wasn't done. Why was that the case?
The pressures from the local regions were very strong from the people, you know? Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. And so they wanted to happen as soon as possible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. Okay.
And who was responsible for making for organizing and managing that program in 2001?
Who was responsible? I think this group of people, you know, including Riaz Rashid.
And in what official capacity were they working?
He was a minister. What was it called? I mean, he was the minister in charge. What capacity? Well, in addition to, you know, this group of people, we got a lot of external support for the implementation of decentralization, which helped. Yeah. There was a lot of capacity building, you know, and so on, given at that time. Yeah. And the people were very enthusiastic, basically. Like CSIS was involved in establishing this, what is now called the Regional Autonomy Watch, KPPOD. You know, we started very early, immediately, you know, to also sort of try to help to ensure the success of the decentralization.
Okay. And so what were the most difficult of the governance changes, the political changes that happened after Suharto's reign?
The most difficult?
Governance changes, the changes in the political system.
The changes in the political system or governance?
Governance, or focus on governance.
Well, of course, you know, now you're going to the big area of civil service reform, the bureaucratic reform, in terms of the political system, of course, political party reform and all that. Those are very difficult things, and even until now, you know, not completed.
Okay.
And in fact, it's the civil service reform which I think continues to be lagging behind.
Why do you think that's the case?
Why has it been the case? You know, if I look back, it is because they put very incompetent people in those posts who are supposed to be in charge of.
So who's put? Is it the president assigning poor cabinet ministers, or is
yes.
it cabinet ministers assigning?
No, it's the minister in charge of administrative reforms.
Okay.
You know, right. We're no longer. They were all given to political parties
okay.
rather than, you know, technocrats. During the time of the Suharto's period, you know, it was strong ministers that put in place of administrative reform, like Sumarlin, Emil Salim, you know, in the past, the economic technocrats were in charge of administrative reform and no longer happen even now. You know, you have a very weak minister in charge.
And do you think this is true because the senior politicians don't want civil service reform to happen, or are they just not interested in making sure that it happens? Are they against it, or is it just not a priority?
Maybe not a priority.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe not a priority. But also, you know, I think because it's given to the wrong people, I believe. You know, if you have a right person in the job, he will do it, even though the president, you know, does not put high priority on it. But if you have the right people, I think things would be different. The reason why you have the wrong people in those positions was that they were given to political parties of the president. They want to make sure, you know, that the bureaucracy continue to be somewhat under their control in terms of, you know, what do you call it, promoting, you know, people and so on. Yeah.
Okay. And what were the goals of the civil service reform, or what have been the goals of the civil service reform as they've been stated?
Well, of course, they have been changing over the years. In the past, number one, they should be loyal. And not necessarily efficiency, but it's loyalty that has been important. Now, you know, on paper, you know, it should become a modern administration, you know, and so on, but of course, you know, it has become very much regimented, because the structures of the ministries and agencies are all very rigid. You know, but having said that, you have a person like Sri Mulyani in the finance ministry, is the largest department in the country with the largest number of civil servants, who is determined to do the reforms. She can do it, you know, even though the minister in charge of administrative reform is not doing anything, she does it on her own.
All right.
And in fact can show some successes. You know? Not fully, but I think she did something. You know, very few ministers have been able to do it.
So why has she been able to do it and other people haven't?
Oh, I think because she put a lot of priority in it. Number one, she believes in the importance of doing it. And then she gets the support from within to do the reforms.
From the president?
Well, the president, yeah, in the end, of course, yeah.
And what have her goals in terms of the reform been within the finance ministry?
Number one, to eliminate corruption. She was very strong on it.
And what sort of corruption?
All kinds of corruption. All kinds of corruption. You know, the Director General of Taxation is under her. That's the one of the most corrupt in the past. You know, because you can just negotiate how much taxes you pay. You know? That's the biggest source of corruption. The second one is customs, also under her, you know. And she had been able to do both the reforms in both.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did she encounter any resistance in those?
Yes.
And where did that come from?
From the people who were going to be removed.
Right. Uh-huh. And how did she get around that? How, I mean, presumably those are fairly powerful people. And why had they been able to stay in the past, but she been able to move them?
Yeah, well, it's just her guts, I think, number one. But I believe the support that she got it from Yusuf Kalla and not from the president. Yeah, you know? And I understand there is a wrong perception, because I was in Singapore until Sunday, and I saw on Singapore television somebody was interviewed and said, the president was very much interested in bureaucratic reform, but the vice president was not. But I thought it's wrong, because I know the case of the finance ministry. The finance minister, without the support of the vice president, would not have been able to do this.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what has her relationship been with the Minister for Administrative Reform?
Let me tell you a story. You know, and this is because I'm a member of Sri Mulyani's, you know, expert group. she confided in us one day, saying that she was the one that took the initiative to report to the Minister for Administrative Reform what she had done and planned to do, you know, because she did this on her own, you know. Other minister was not there. They would ask for permission from the ministry, but I think she didn't. So she just introduced the reforms, and then she reported to the minister. You know, she came to the minister and said, this is what I have done. She made a presentation, and what she told me is that at the end of the presentation, this is just for you, this minister told her, that's exactly what needs to be done. That's all, his comment to her. Yeah.
And so what have her most successful reforms been since she took over at the finance ministry? Apart from the anti-corruption, what else has she done?
Oh, but that's a major thing, you know, streamlining the bureaucracy. You know, that's the major thing. You know, customs, what happens in the ports had been horrible before, you know. In the past, what we did was just replace the customs with SGS, a foreign company, to do all the things for us, you know. Well, you can't do it, you know. For a big country like Indonesia, it's an insult, you know. Smaller countries, in fact, you know, in Africa, do use SGS to do the customs for them. But, you know, Indonesia should not do it. So we have been able to overcome that now. And then taxation. You know, everybody knew, you know, how corrupt it was. So the beginning, of course, was with, again, an IMF reform package of introducing these large taxpayers' offices. So you know who the large taxpayers are. They now have to go into a particular office where everything is computerized, you know, and where this face-to-face, what do you call it, meetings with tax officers are minimized.
Okay. Mm.
So that began with an IMF program, but it was continued throughout. But of course, the important thing was to be able to replace the people and put the right people in the right place.
So I understand that most of the control over personnel happens at Menpan, the
yes.
Ministry for Administrative Reform. But has Sri Mulyani been able to take over that? And how did she get that responsibility and that power?
I think she just did that.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a gamble. It must be a gamble. So she just did that. Mm-mm. Yeah.
And how was she able to get rid of, and how was she able to change the way tax and customs were done to reduce corruption?
By, you know, putting the people in it that she trusted.
Okay.
And they were very clean people afterwards. Yeah. So, you know, selecting the right people. In the end, in a country like Indonesia, you know, you give the right example. That's my thesis, you know. If the top gives an example, you know, but also institute, you know, of course you have to institute a mechanism to control, you know, of course you can do it.
So I understand that she's also developed this bureaucracy reform working group out of the reforms that she's done in the finance ministry. What is their responsibility and what are they doing
at
the moment?
I'm not sure I know.
Okay.
About it, yeah.
All right. That's fine. So what are the major challenges facing the civil service in Indonesia at the moment, as you understand them?
Oh. I think that their challenges they operate in a situation where they no longer, I think, feel like there is certainty in what they do. Huh? You know? You know, this is talking in general. In general. I think the civil service has been at a loss at the moment because of the changes over the past 10 years. You know, each time there is a change in the minister, you know, you change these things, you know, in terms of personnel, you know, bringing in people and so on. You know, and it's not clear what the criteria is for people to be promoted and so on. Because you have political people now in as ministers, yeah? They bring their political people in, and that created, you know, a lot of it has some demoralizing effect inside many of the ministries. But the other thing is also that with this very serious effort at curbing corruption, and you know, corruption is everywhere. Nobody dares to do anything now in the bureaucracy. So it's very hard to get things moving these days because nobody wants to be responsible for anything for which they can't have full control. Okay. And so, for instance, you know, if you have become a project leader, you're fully responsible for what you're doing, but you don't have full control over, you know, the implementation and the bureaucracy that is in charge, because the mechanisms are not there. And so civil servants become very hesitant to become project leaders. And anecdotally, I understand from some of my colleagues in the government saying that, you know, each time they will have to go through a test at the planning board. The Bappenas, you know, is the one that administered this test for civil servants, you know, who would be promoted to become project leaders. And many of them tried to fail the exams so that they would not be given the responsibility to become project leaders because they're so concerned about their ability to, you know, to have full control over a project. And once they don't, you know, they will easily be, you know, now they can easily be caught by the Corruption Commission, and once you're there, you know, it's hard.
So apart from the civil service, what other reforms have been attempted but have failed?
Judicial reform.
Okay.
Which is even a greater priority.
Right.
The judicial reform.
And why has that failed?
Corruption is so entrenched in that you ask me, I don't know.
Okay. And the main reform in the judiciary is to reduce corruption.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Corruption in the sense that, you know, justice has become a commodity in this country. You know, if you are billing, you are able to pay, you know, then you get justice. But if you can't pay, you can't have justice. That's the biggest problem. This country. So don't get into trouble so that you don't have to face the courts. Then you're okay. But once you're in there, you know, if you don't have enough money, you can't bribe your way out, then you're in big trouble. And that's what these central bankers, you know, who are in jail have tried to do, because they were forced to bribe them.
So, and you don't know, you can't think of why the reforms have failed. What do you think the problem is that makes it difficult to reform that sort of system?
I said it's so entrenched. You don't know where to start.
Okay.
We believed initially that, you know, you change the Supreme Court, you change them, you get really good people, then you could do it. And we thought we had the right people there. You know, it turns out not to be the case. So I really don't know where to start, you know. When I was in the National Economic Council, we invited a few consultants from the outside to, you know, provide us with ideas of what how to reform the judicial system, and some came, you know, in the end, the suggestion was replace all the judges, bring in new people from universities, you know, to occupy those positions. It didn't work. And they said this was successful in either Estonia or Latvia, you know.
But Estonia and Latvia is a very different country from...
Oh, of course, it's so much smaller, yeah. Mm. So we were told to do the same here, you can't. And since I don't know what else, you know.
So what is the public's attitudes towards the reform? Is the public very much behind them? Does the public understand what the reforms are doing? Does it make a difference between whether it's the rural public and the urban public? And how does that affect
maybe,
the reforms?
Of course, the urban public are more, you know, not necessarily, well, I'm not quite sure to tell you frankly, but they want to see corruption eliminated. And I think that's the main reason why they would support this. Better service given to them, you know, that they don't have to pay their way all around and so on. It's something the public understands. They do understand this. Yeah. There is a lot of support for this. Yeah.
And does that drive the reforms through the democratic process?
I think so.
I'm thinking about the election tomorrow. Is the effect of reform going to influence the election?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Of the very few factors in the various polls on election, voting behavior, and so on. Huh? Of course, dealing with corruption is seen as a very important thing for, you know, the voters, how they perceive, you know, somebody to be a competent person or a political party. In terms, you know, by their policies on corruption and so on, is rather high up. Of course, economic well-being and all that is number one. But afterwards, it's, you know, corruption.
So, just one of the last questions: what are the major impediments to reform in Indonesia? What do you think the major obstacles are?
To have a mechanism that can really follow it through. Yeah. You know, we have, since 2004, when we ended our program with the International Monetary Fund, we have basically adopt the same method. Namely, you know, have these reform policy packages. Now it's called presidential instructions. In 2004 there was one, in 2005 there was one, I think in 2007, 2008, and now 2009 there is presidential decree number 5 this year, mm-hmm. which is, you know, in fact, put everything under this in presidential instruction very clearly what needs to be done, you know, including our commitments that we made in regional arrangements like ASEAN to implement the ASEAN Economic Community Blueprint, you know, of further integrating with the region and so on. The few steps that we have committed ourselves to do in ASEAN were integrated into the reform package with clearly, you know, timetables and so on. But then it's a mechanism of monitoring, you know, and so on, that is very weak.
Okay. So it's continuing through with your reforms and monitoring them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is there anything you'd like to add before I finish the interview?
No, I think basically that's, you know, how I would like to describe the process of reform in Indonesia. You know, you have pressures sometimes coming from the outside, but also more and more coming from the inside, you know, themselves, for the government to, you know, undertake these pressures. And, you know, in the government, you do have people who champion them And it so happened that, you know, they would be the one in charge of formulating the policies, and they are there. But then in the end, you have problems with implementing them. In part because, you know, a few ministers do not feel like they are committed to them. And they are mostly ministers that are there representing political parties, you know, compared to the ones that are appointed directly by the president, you know, as professionals, but these political people are not. And second, even if you have ministers who are very eager to implement them, you know, but can't implement because the capacity of the bureaucracy is so low. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
You're most welcome.